Hello, everybody. This is Scott Yates, Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission, here with episode 122 of Wheat All About It, or what I'm calling the World Wheat O'Clock Report Returns. This is the fourth in a series of Wheat O'Clock Reports, which I've produced. Be prepared for a fire hose of information of interest to the wheat industry in a 20-minute gulp. Because you're out feeding the world, I sift through dozens of periodicals, newspapers, and online sources to condense articles I believe farmers, landlords, agribusinesses, and anybody else who eats might find compelling. Ahead in the World Wheat O'Clock Report, you'll find international and domestic news about events, products, and trends affecting farmers and, of course, our favorite crop. It's how I imagine the media might cover wheat if there wasn't enough of it. Now, without further ado, I bring you the World Wheat O'Clock Report. Hello, I'm Scott Yates with the World Wheat O'Clock Report. Here are today's headlines from the world of wheat. Herbicide-resistant Armageddon. Herbicide resistance is being expressed by weeds throughout the Northwest, but the region still lags the Midwest when it comes to the worst examples of the phenomenon. In Indiana, the related weeds, Palmer amaranth and water hemp, are now resistant to seven herbicide modes of action. Groups 2, 4, 5, 9, 14, 15, and 27. The first resistant water hemp appeared in the state in the early 1990s. Many farmers are now dealing with water hemp that has three-way resistance. Drew Lyon, extension weed scientist at Washington State University, said the same thing could happen in eastern Washington if farmers are not vigilant with regard to rotating modes of action. Relying on a single mode of action for weed control until it no longer works, and only then switching to another mode of action, is a proven recipe for developing weed biotype resistance to multiple modes of action, he said. Not wheat's fight. Since 2007, the change in consumer concern and avoidance of all things GMO has risen sharply in the U.S., according to the Hartman Group, an authority on consumers, culture, and trends for food and beverage brands. The proportion of consumers avoiding GMOs almost tripled to 46% by 2018 compared to only 15% 11 years earlier. The Hartman Group said GMO negativity is part of a broader societal shift toward eating food that is closer to its natural form and less changed by human manipulation. Consumers imagine that eating foods made by nature reclaims an imagined time when food production was simpler and safer. Concern about GMOs is fueled by, number one, discomfort with the idea of natural products being changed into something unnatural. Number two, distrust of big business with profit motivations. And number three, uncertainty about the long-term consequences of GMOs on people and the environment. Nitrogen fixation, fact or fiction? Nitrogen is all around us, and while plants need it to make proteins and DNA, they have never evolved the biochemical equipment to fix nitrogen for their own use. Legumes have solved the problem by encouraging bacteria, which fix nitrogen, to live on their roots, going so far as to develop root nodules to encourage cohabitation. Doing for wheat what legumes have evolved is part of a University of Wisconsin-Madison project that seeks to recapitulate a fortuitous coincidence that occurred 60 million years ago between the symbiosis genes and the root formation genes of an ancient type of legume. This will be accomplished by genetically tweaking the evolutionary process to speed it up. It turns out there are already examples of corn and sorghum plants that fix nitrogen. In Mexico, a type of corn that stands nearly 20 feet tall when fully grown does not need fertilizer to flourish. It puts out aerial roots that do not absorb water, but rather host nitrogen-fixing bacteria. When conditions are damp, these roots ooze a gel that drips onto the soil. Analysis has shown the gel is fixing nitrogen. Nitrogen-fixing aerial roots have also been found in sorghum. Hurry up and wait. The USMCA trade agreement between the U.S., Canada, and Mexico was agreed upon by all parties several months ago, but it cannot go into effect without the approval of Congress. Since the trade treaty was negotiated, however, Democrats have become the majority party in the House, and they want to reopen the treaty to address labor rights and pharmaceutical issues. How their reservations can be addressed is anybody's guess. Meanwhile, President Trump is not making things any easier, with threats to close the Mexican border and add on tariffs to cars coming from the country. But it is imperative the USMCA treaty be put to bed because a bilateral deal with Japan can't be acted upon until it is. As a Washington grain commissioner put it, comparing the USMCA's congressional passage to life on a ranch, "It's like a cow getting stuck in a cattle chute. Ain't nothing getting past it." Making more with less. Japan is aging rapidly, and its working age population has shrunk by 4.7 million people since 2012. And yet, the number of people working in the country increased by 4.4 million. That's more than any other advanced economy. What's going on? Turns out the second longest expansion in Japan's history is being fueled by employing more of the elderly, women, and foreigners. Beware, cattlemen. The meatless hamburger has taken the world by storm, with various fast food outlets, including Carl's and Burger King, releasing versions of the burger which has pea protein as its main ingredient. The Carl's burgers are said to target the flexitarian consumer, or anyone looking to add more plant-based foods to their diet, but who continue to eat meat too. Beyond Meat is providing the patties at Carl's, while Impossible Foods is providing Burger King's inventory. Beyond Meat was founded in 2009 with the goal to benefit human health, climate change, natural resource conservation, and animal welfare by building meat directly from plants. Impossible Foods is more militaristic. Its website says using animals to make meat is a prehistoric and destructive technology. Quote, "Animal agriculture occupies almost half the land on Earth, consumes a quarter of our fresh water, and destroys our ecosystems. So we're doing something about it. We're making meat using plants so that we never have to use animals again." The next new thing is the General Mills initiative to develop 1 million acres of land in the U.S. under the flag of regenerative agriculture, the canary in the coal mine. The Minneapolis-based food giant plans to partner with organic and conventional farmers, suppliers, and farm advisors in key growing regions to deploy practices designed to protect and intentionally enhance natural resources and farming communities. Last spring, the company introduced Annie's branded products using regenerative-produced elbow pasta from Montana farms. The company is also working alongside the Land Institute to commercialize organic kernza, a perennial grain. Got bread? It's just a matter of time before a flour checkoff is up and running. Christine Cochran, executive director of the Grain Foods Foundation, spoke before the U.S. Wheat Associates winter board meeting in Washington, D.C. about the initiative, which could generate as much as $15 million a year for promotion and other activities. The flour assessment will be directed toward the bread and roll segment and will exclude soft white wheat. Millers and bakers are concerned about tepid flour disappearance and are hoping to ramp up interest in baked goods. An assessment of 16 cents per hundredweight of flour will be levied, with 13.5 cents of that paid by bakers and 2.5 cents by millers. Stay tuned for a late maturity alpha amylase alert right after this word from our sponsor. The Washington Grain Commission is dedicated to working on behalf of Eastern Washington's wheat farmers and landlords to maintain a strong industry. With upwards of 90% of Washington's wheat exported to Asia and Latin America, it is essential to understand what our overseas customers want. Recently, WGC Commissioners Ben Barstow, Mike Karstensen, Kevin Klein, and Scott Steinbacher, as well as WGC Program Director Joe Bippert, went back to school at the International Grains Program Institute for 3 days of intensive study. Located in Manhattan, Kansas, the Institute is affiliated with Kansas State University. From classroom discussions to hands-on training, the Grain Commission contingent learned the specifics of milling, how different wheats perform in mills, and what all that means for baking functionality. Education never stops at the WGC because we know that knowing what customers want is vital to the success of Eastern Washington wheat farmers. And we're back. Sharp eyes on your crop and your thermometer. Farmers should be on the lookout for low temperatures about 20 days after wheat anthesis or pollen shedding. Based on new research, the trigger for low falling numbers caused by late maturity alpha amylase, LMA, is not the result of a variation of morning and afternoon temperatures, but rather cold temperatures alone. Chloe Liu Chung, a graduate student at WSU in the Crop and Soils Department, presented research she conducted in growth chambers in which she attempted to induce the LMA phenomenon. Cold is key, she said. WSU wheat breeder Aaron Carter said recently that given this year's wacky weather, it's hard to estimate when heading will be. Last year, Lynn flowered between May 15th and May 24th. Pullman flowered between May 24th and June 6th. Carter initially believed that flowering would be later this year given how long snow stayed on the ground, but a quick warm-up might put the crop on a more normal track. Kim Campbell, club wheat breeder at the Agricultural Research Service, said she has gone to a growing degree day approach in her plots rather than a calendar date. She said the time to LMA susceptibility was longer last year because of the cool spring, but with this year's forecast predicted to be warmer, then it should be earlier. Campbell said an LMA problem that occurred in the Lind-Ritzville area in 2018 was probably the result of a dip in temperature below 30 degrees in the June 11th to 12th timeframe. You can hear all the latest falling number news in a trio of episodes, 113, 114, and 115, from the 2019 Falling Numbers Summit held in Portland earlier this year. Go to the Washington Grain Commission website at wagrains.org and click on Podcast Summaries at the bottom of the page to find the episodes. Proactive education. What do you get when you combine the words innovation and nature? How about innovature? That's the name of a new effort to educate the public about the value of advanced plant breeding techniques like gene editing. Go to the Innovature website to find out more about the partnership between the American Seed Trade Association and BIO, the world's largest biotech trade association. The goal of the new project is to avoid the problems that befell GMOs by engaging key influencers in a conversation around shared values to explore how gene editing can improve our planet, our health, and our food. The project aims to move the needle toward support in the U.S. A marketing opportunity. Thanks to the Agricultural Trade Promotion Program, ATP, a three-year President Trump initiative intended to help U.S. agricultural exporters develop new markets and help mitigate the adverse effects of other countries' tariff and non-tariff barriers, U.S. Wheat Associates' budget will rise from $16.3 million in 2018 to $19.3 million in 2019, according to Vince Peterson, the organization's president. U.S. Wheat will use the funds over the next 3 years. More good news is the additional $700,000 in foreign market development funds the organization received. The 2019 budget raises the number of times producer funds are matched by the federal government from 1.7 to 2.4 times. Growers' dues provide $5.3 million of the USW budget. Fun factoids. From the Wheat Industry's National Communicators Meeting held recently in New Orleans, J.J. Jones, a partner in Roots and Legacies Consulting, a Kansas-based public relations firm, noted several trends. 1. Emotion is the key to open the door to science and fact. 2. A social consensus, once driven by white males, is no more. Today, there is no single consensus, but a great diversity of many voices. 3. In 1960, 13% of the U.S. population lived in single-person households. In 2018, 36% did. 4. By 2020, about 6 gigabytes of information will be created for every human being every hour, every day. 1 gigabyte represents about 700,000 pages. Not worth it. Farmers wanting to sell their wheat for double or triple the price of the market could just call it organic. That's what Missouri farmer Randy Constant did from 2010 to 2017, selling tens of millions of dollars of non-organic grain as though it were organic. Constant was convicted of the fraud, forfeited $128 million, and faces a maximum 20-year term in prison and a $250,000 fine. The 61-year-old says he's broke. Eliminating risk, a fool's errand. We're not safer when we try to eliminate risk from our environment. Turns out our bodies thrive on a little bit of struggle when it comes to challenging them with the dirt, germs, and bacteria that were an everyday part of our existence until quite recently. Our immune system needs a job, says Meg Lemon, a dermatologist in Denver, who treats people with allergies and autoimmune disorders. We evolved over millions of years to have our immune systems under constant assault. Now they don't have anything to do. The hygiene hypothesis as the origin for many of our illnesses is not new. In 1872, a British medical journal suggested that hay fever was an aristocratic disease because it was almost always confined to the upper classes, that is, to people who had more access to hygienic practices. In 1958, it was discovered that hay fever in families depended upon family size, meaning the more children, the less likely they were to get allergies. The reason? Unhygienic contact with older siblings. More recently, the percentage of children with a food allergy in the U.S. rose 50% between 1999 and 2011. Skin allergies jumped 69%. A rising tide, etc. It's always positive when U.S. wheat obtains a more level playing field in countries around the world, most recently in Brazil, where President Trump and President Jair Bolsonaro of Brazil agreed to implement a tariff-free duty rate quota for wheat. The agreement opens up an annual opportunity for U.S. wheat farmers to compete for 750,000 metric tons of wheat under the TRQ. Brazil was the largest wheat importer in Latin America and the fourth largest in the world in marketing year 2017-2018. Until now, wheat purchased from countries outside the South American Mercosur Agreement had a 10% duty imposed on wheat coming into the country. Although distance makes it unlikely Brazil would ever be a PNW customer for grain, the region's wheat is actually prohibited from being exported to Brazil over fears of flag smut, a disease that seed treatments have eradicated from the Northwest. That's all the news we have for this edition of the World Wheat Clock Report. Please join me again next time for more international and domestic news about our favorite crop. And I'm back. That is the Scott Yates, who is Director of Communications and Producer Relations for the Washington Grain Commission and alter ego of the dashing Wheat O'Clock Report news anchor. I hope you've enjoyed episode 122 of Wheat All About It, or what I entitled, The World Wheat O'Clock Report Returns. Please join me here next week for episode 123, the first of a two-part episode on a tour of Lower Monumental Dam, right here on Wheat All About It!